Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
There is a queer angle to every issue, and we will find it. But don't expect us to be nice or politically correct. Nothing is sacred. And the team will be finding the queer and profane wherever we can on Joy 94.9. Is nothing sacred?
Hi, Joysters. You're on Is Nothing Sacred with Jim, Patrick and Steph.
Hello.
And we've got a big show tonight.
We do. I'm very excited. So next up, we have Peter Miller, who's going to be talking to us about alcohol-fueled violence. And we also have Rob Sparrow in the studio, who's going to be talking to us about climate engineering.
And we also want to say a big thank you to LDs for Suffolk City. How good is it to hear Woo-hoo. Smart young lesbians on the air? Finally.
For a change, yeah, you know.
Apart from the fact we've had one for the past four grids on our show.
Just teasing. And I'd like to say we'd like to make a bit of a call out, shout out, announcement to all of you listeners. We're actually looking for a new person to join our team. So if you're interested in becoming our podcaster.
And learning how to podcast. We'll teach you how to do it.
Learning how to podcast. You can put it on your resume. I have it on my resume. And I actually got my current job partly because of my role here at Joy. So it's a great thing to do. If you're interested, text us now on air@joy.org.au or you can SMS 0427JOY949.
Or you can ring Robert on the front desk.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Robert. Or we also have our Facebook page, which is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. If you look that up on Facebook, you can find us.
And we also are going to put out a lovely little bid, which is currently Joy is having the tech drive, which is fantastic. So that's happening because basically we're looking for anyone who's able to donate any money at all for new computers, monitors,
and
headphones.
And you know, Pat, that somebody today donated $500. Can anybody beat that out there?
Woo!
I will do something if you donate that money.
That's a challenge.
How nice it would be if we had a microphone that actually stayed up and didn't droop slowly during the show so that we continue to have to hold it up. That would be nice.
So for anyone listening, a tech drive is about getting money to replace our equipment so that, as you say, we can have microphones that function, et cetera, et cetera.
And all donations over $2 are tax deductible. All the funds will go to new equipment, upgrading current systems, and all for us volunteers who make Joy happen.
Woohoo!
This is why we are on air 24/7.
It is exactly why we are on air 24/7.
I mean, Pat and I were even on Christmas Day.
Yes, we were.
We were.
Yes. There's some commitment.
The tech drive finishes
Christmas
on,
pudding at other
on
people.
Sunday.
Finishes on Sunday, so please donate if you can.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLD, TIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You're with James, Kurt, Steph and Pat on Is Nothing Sacred? Joy 94.9.
Hi, Joysters. You're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's 9 minutes past 10. And if you want to make any comments on what we're talking about tonight, you can SMS us on 0427JOY949. Or you can email us onair@joy.org.au and we'd love to hear from you. You can go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/ is nothing sacred on Joy 94.9. Or you can ring Robert. Hello, Robert. You can ring Robert on the front desk on 1300 Joy 949. And hello, James. James has just walked into the studio.
Hello, guys. How are you?
Very good. We understand that you had a domestic problem tonight.
Not people related though, thank goodness.
Just
machines. They're breaking on me. It's a rush.
We're now going to be talking a little bit. We're talking with Peter Miller, who has worked a lot with alcohol, speaking about alcohol-fueled violence, and actually has there's a documentary that he was involved in, did 13 hours of filming in, which is going to be on tomorrow on the ABC. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
Lovely to have you on. Thank you so much. I know you have an early flight tomorrow, so thank you for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Oh, no, it's an absolute pleasure. So let us get stuck into this. Specifically, obviously, we've talked a little bit about alcohol to violence in the past in relation to the lockout laws, where primarily this is where you guys were filming, obviously, around King's Cross, which is why this sort of reaction has occurred, creating the lockout laws with Barry O'Farrell, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think we need to be clear about the lockout laws firstly. Just
okay.
It's funny because the language is a little bit incorrect. The actual effective part of the whole intervention is stopping service of alcohol at 3 a.m. So, you know, shutting pubs, or in Sydney's case, they actually just stopped the service of alcohol. That's a bit that's effective. The lockout at 1:30, which everybody seems to be focused on, that's kind of the minor player in the whole thing, certainly from the evidence we've done, from the studies we've conducted.
However, it seems that the one thing that does seem to be a problem with these laws, we will refrain from calling it lockout laws, but from stopping the sale of alcohol at 3 a.m. in the morning, that's not a problem. But it seems that it's very selective, because the areas that they're focusing on is literally about six steps away from the casino, which is not affected by these laws.
Absolutely. I mean, we conducted some very large studies. We compared Newcastle to Geelong over 2 years and spoke to over 4,000 people in the nighttime economy and a whole lot of other stuff. And our conclusions actually said, look, these laws worked fantastically in Newcastle in terms of changing culture, reducing violence and injury and all sorts of things. But you have to do it statewide. You have to do it right across the board. Otherwise, you create all of these weird things where people won't go to one place, but they will go to somewhere else just because they can drink for a couple of hours longer. Now, that's going to create problems.
It's just a recreation of the 6 o'clock swill, isn't it, if you do that?
Well, the 6 o'clock swill is a long way away. You know, I think we kind of need to move on from that. We are talking about 1:30 a.m. where people have to be inside, and 3 a.m. And the Newcastle laws intervention was really effective in terms of, we got a 37% reduction in assaults. We got a reduction of over 300 cases presenting at the emergency department. We really saw people. The big change was people just went out a bit earlier, and they actually spent more in pubs. And there's more venues in Newcastle now than there was in 2008 when they were put in place. So I don't think we're talking about relocating the 6 o'clock swill.
So it really does change culture, does it?
Look, that's the evidence we've got today. I think, you know, each entertainment district is different, and we're going to have to look very carefully at what happens in New South Wales around that culture, but that's the evidence we've got to date. And we've certainly seen that in international studies as well, where they've done that in Norway, in the US. We talk sort of about prohibition and things like that, but the US and all of their cities shut it too, essentially, apart from New York. So
I ask, I know some of one of the potential criticisms that people were concerned about was the impact that it would have on business. So are you saying that there wasn't negative impacts on business in terms of sales?
Well, I think it's important to think about what sort of business you want. And there are certainly some, if they don't change their business model, they will go out of business. But then you've also got to look at what sort of business they are and whether you want them in place. Now, in Newcastle, there were two licensed venues that went under out of 14. One of them burned down, so that's not a big problem. Well, it is a big problem then.
It wasn't affected, though, by... we know what you mean.
Down because of the law.
Maybe it was a very, very angry drinker.
Yeah. And look, the other one, Sue, it was primarily a shots bar that opened at midnight and just had massive problems associated. Now, we compared it to Geelong, as I said, and we had 12 businesses go out of business over the same period. So, you know, businesses succeeding or failing is part of the business environment. It will affect businesses. The ones that are good need to change their business model.
Okay, we'll come back and we'll talk more about this immediately after these announcements.
Thank you. You've been on Is Nothing Sacred. You're with Is Nothing Sacred. We're not leaving yet. You're with Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Is Nothing Sacred?
with Pat, James, Kurt and Steph. Joy 94.9.
Hi, Joysters. You are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's Jim here and I'm here with Pat. Hello, Pat.
Hello.
James. Hello, James.
Hi, guys.
Hello, Steph.
Hello, Jim.
And we've got Peter Miller on the phone. Hello, Peter. You still there?
I still am, yes.
Great.
Oh, excellent.
Sorry we lost you earlier. We're back here, though. Back into the
technology
our snake
works.
Pit.
This is why, Joy listeners, we are having the tech drive to improve our technological abilities by getting equipment that actually works and doesn't glitch.
It does work most times. This was an anomaly. Let's just point out this was an anomaly. But James,
Peter, I've been itching to ask a question. Obviously, we're staying specifically with the lockout policy, but I'm just wondering, just thinking about it from a practical point of view and things that potentially might not show up in the statistics, which undoubtedly you've mentioned have been a success in Newcastle. External factors and other, you know, ideas that, you have mentioned that it may push issues outside the periphery of what's measurable. I know, for instance, a lot of the younger generation particularly tend to pre-drink a lot. There's a lot of alcohol consumed earlier in the night, particularly large amounts in a large binge. Are there external factors associated with our drinking culture that really need to be addressed to get a more holistic approach?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. The pre-drinking, we actually identified that as being the biggest predictor of harm. So the more you pre-drink before you go out, the more likely you are to get into a fight, whether that be as perpetrator or victim. Mm-hmm. And we actually found that is stronger in the entertainment districts where they go later. So the trend is kind of reverse to what you might think. Mm-hmm. Essentially, people who are going out later are drinking more before they go out, so they're spending less in the pubs.
And we used this in when I was working in government, we used this in VCAT cases to prevent the opening of extra bottle shops around the metropolitan area, because I think it might have even been your research, Peter, that actually showed that people were coming from places where new bottle shops were opening up to deal with demand and drinking on the trains on their way into the city and then going to...
some colleagues of mine at Turning Point actually did most of that, Michael Livingston and Sarah McLeod, and it was great research that showed that. I think what we really showed by having such big numbers was the strength of that association, and it comes back to the differential in price. But when we looked at particularly at Newcastle, what was really worrying was the licensees there were actually able to buy booze cheaper from Dan Murphy's than they were from their wholesalers. So that creates a really difficult environment for them to operate in. But it also means that people who are going out are purchasing alcohol much cheaper than it's ever been before in relation to wages. So that creates a really difficult situation when we're trying to manage the nighttime environments, because a lot of the driver from harm is coming from somewhere else.
That's certainly, been my experience. There's certainly a lot of drinks out there. I think, was it with the alcopops tax that it just sort of migrated, kids migrated onto buying the pure spirits or the, cast wine or something like that. They're just basically finding the cheaper per standard drink. Is that right? For instance?
We didn't really have stuff out. We didn't have surveys running over when the alcopops tax was put in place, so we can't really document the effects of that. We know it reduced consumption across Australia overall, but whether people substituted more harmful.
Yeah, Rob Moody's research showed that a bit, I think, and they used that in the prevention task force.
I have a bit of a different question, Peter. I remember some research done a few years ago by perhaps one of your colleagues, Darren Palmer, who was his work talking about the negative impact of particularly tabloid media reporting on alcohol-fueled violence and that having links to actually increased levels of anxiety and violence and aggression and decreased feelings of safety. And I was just wondering your views on how do we balance making sure we don't ignore the problem while also not inadvertently driving rates upwards by making people feel fearful and perhaps under attack and therefore maybe carrying a knife where they otherwise wouldn't, for example?
Yeah, or hitting someone from behind or hitting them harder and making sure they stay down because they're so afraid of if they get up. It's a really difficult phenomenon. I think what we need is to see some really good journalism in terms of describing what's happening. I think it's really important to say this violence was around 20 or 30 years ago to a degree. What's really changed is our awareness of it and our intolerance of it in a lot of ways. I think society's saying we're not happy about this anymore. But as you correctly described, we've kind of gone to the other extreme where we see every graphic picture that could possibly be taken thrown up onto the front pages. And we need to be careful about that. I think what we're not doing is clearly relaying the message that these environments can be dangerous, but they generally are not terribly dangerous. So, for example, we've spoken to 13,000 people in the last 5 years. We were sober and we didn't have an incident.
So are rates actually going up if you consider as on a per capita level?
No. Rates are stable or declining depending on the type of violence you want to look at. And different areas, obviously, and different times of the night. So what we did see was we have seen, in some areas, increases in terms of nightlife-related violence late at night, but in a lot of other areas it's been stable or declining, particularly over the last 5 years. And that's not surprising when you think about all of the media and all of the messages that are out there.
Jim had an awesome suggestion before. I think this is the way of the future.
I've just noticed that there's a new trend in Europe, which has had quite a lot of publicity. It's been getting quite a lot of publicity in the nightlife and entertainment trade media at the moment for the development of non-alcoholic drink bars, so mocktail bars. And what I've heard is there are a couple of them about to open up in Melbourne. I don't know where they are, but when we find out who they are, we might get them on and have a bit of a talk to them. But It's a booming area, apparently, in parts of Europe to have these non-alcoholic bars. So they sell things like smart drinks, you know, the mixed blueberries and cranberries. Yep. With
oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
They're supposed to increase your neural pathways.
I'm not sure I'm convinced, Jim, because, correct me if I'm wrong,
I'm a non-drinker.
Peter, but my understanding is a lot of where we see these violent incidences are either on the street or in the larger venues, and that the smaller niche bars tend to have lower rates of violence. And it sounds like a bit of a small niche hipster thing to attend.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is very much on the streets or outside the bigger or inside the bigger venues where we see that violence. Look, I think those sort of businesses are probably some of the way of the future. Obviously, they're going to be niche, but we've also been recently describing a lot of trends around people taking breaks from drinking, and you know the Jill Stark sort of story, challenging that whole notion that you have to drink to be sociable.
Does there also need to be work done around the way in which the security people manage the lines of people outside large drink venues, and perhaps there should be restrictions on the size of venues, because you know, been a few really big 1,000 people bars opened up in Melbourne in the last couple of years, which weren't here before.
Yeah, look, and they're associated with a lot more harm. You're just pouring a lot more people into the same area, and it's just more of a recipe for disaster. But I think, security's got a lot better over the last 15 years or so. So those things are being managed, and we've got some good systems beginning to come into place. New South Wales got a terrific system, the violent venues list, which we could really use in other states where you identify the problem venues and then people can choose whether they go to them or not.
Just speaking quickly, we're just about to wrap up, but I just want to ask, tomorrow there will be a documentary which you were very heavily involved in on the ABC. I did mention it earlier. Can you describe a little bit about what went into that, just very briefly, and of course we'll make sure we all tune in so we get more of a view of this.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen it myself.
Oh, fantastic.
Because it was only filmed a week and a half ago. So it was filmed on the April the 5th. And it had six film crews. One of them I spent a lot of time with doing interviews right until about 5:45. So if I stumble a bit on my words, please forgive me.
That's fine.
But we also followed a hen's night, a 21st, a crew of police, and you know, also went to the emergency department and things like that. And what they were able to do was just document the night as an event it'll be quite interesting. And it really tries to get all sides of the story. And then there's actually follows up with a forum on ABC Two with Tom Tilley.
Brilliant. Well, we'll all be tuning into that one. Thank you very much for joining us, Peter. Have a good sleep and good luck for tomorrow as well.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Fantastic.
Mm. We will be right back. You are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Is Nothing Sacred? With Pat, James, Kurt and Steph. Joy 94.9.
Hi, Joyce, as you are on Is Nothing Sacred. It's 28 minutes to 11. And you can SMS us in on Joy on 0427 Joy 949 or email us in on air at joy.org.au or ring Robert on 1300 Joy 949. And, of course, Nurse James has actually contacted us and he's rabbited on about something about... good on you, Nurse James. Rabbited on about something about young adults and the culture of drinking.
So Nurse James is one of our regular listeners.
And a sometime contributor to the show. He comes on sometimes. But I'm not giving you a run on this one, Nurse James.
So we're moving on to quite a different topic now. We've got Associate Professor Robert Sparrow here in the studio, and we're going to be talking a bit about climate engineering, which is something that I've been quite interested in and been really keen to have someone to come on the talk on this show. So I'm very excited we can discuss this issue with someone much more informed than myself. So hello.
Hello.
So what do people mean when they talk about climate engineering?
People are talking about doing consciously what human beings are doing unconsciously at the moment, which is trying to shape the ecosystemic processes on a global scale. So conscious interventions to change the temperature of the planet, typically as a response to global warming. So the thought is that we're not doing anything else. Catastrophe is just around the corner. So we should be looking into the possibility of consciously trying to change the atmosphere, essentially, or rates of sunlight impinging on a planet. So very massive, large-scale crisis, rapid engineering project to try to prevent catastrophe.
So I guess in broad layperson terms, what are some of the technologies that might be used to do this?
So people are talking about two different classes of technologies. There's quite a sort of recent enthusiasm. The longer we leave taking effective political action on climate change, the more it looks as though these sorts of emergency measures start to look plausible. So people are talking about two sorts of interventions. One is trying to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So we've had a lot of conversation in Australia about what they call geosequestration, which is the idea that we're going to continue to have coal-fired power plants, but rather than pumping sort of toxic gases into the atmosphere, you'll have some magic machine that extracts the carbon dioxide and stores it safely underground forever. And particularly the conservative side of politics in Australia has been putting a lot of stock in this as their response to climate change. That looks as though it won't be enough and that we actually need to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. There's a range of technologies that people have looked at to do that. Planting trees is an easy one. Pumping an enormous amount of iron, like iron filings, into the ocean to change the way that planktons treat the atmosphere. People are looking at carbon scrubbers, so machines that are somehow going to suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And then people are also talking about trying to reduce the amount of sunlight the amount of heat from sunlight that's staying in the atmosphere. So this is everything from giant space-based mirrors that are actually, you know, a big sun mirror in outer space, to getting everyone to paint their roof white or covering the ocean in polystyrene beads. So anything that you can do to either reduce the amount of sunlight coming into the atmosphere or increase...
We'll never find MH370 if you do that, Ron.
No, it'll be that much harder once the ocean is completely white. So these are very radical technological changes. I'm surprised by how practical some of the engineers take these technologies to be, but it's partially just in comparison with people's complete failure to take what seems to me the more sensible policy option, which is changing our economy to a zero carbon economy.
But isn't it just the old thing of, I mean, people have been doing this in health for years and years and years. We won't worry about it. We'll just let the inventions get a new technology to solve our problems. It's this whole put your future in the hands of the scientists and everything will be solved.
Yes, I think that's very much the case.
Hasn't really worked in health.
No, well, so often the root causes of the problems we face are social and political. I mean, of course, I'm a philosopher. I would say that, but I also take it to be true that that particularly with climate change, this is a problem that human beings have produced with our existing technology, and there are other ways of solving it than these very sort of radical measures. Of course, we're not taking the necessary action. And that's one of the strange things about this debate, is if you assume that we're heading for catastrophe, then maybe someone should be firing nuclear missiles at the moon to, you know, create a cloud of dust in outer space that will shade the Earth. But I would like... I mean, the problem here is the more we rely on this future possibility, the less likely it is that we will take action now. As you say, people will say, well, we don't need to worry about it. Let the robots handle it, you know?
Robert, that was sort of my point. I mean, it's heady stuff. I'm in sort of two minds still about it, though. I mean, because I still do value... science greatly and its ability to do good. I suppose it's a question of motives, isn't it? It's about when, you know, you were mentioning before about the conservative side of Australian politics with their white knight carbon sequestration, which seemed more of, you know, if you drill down, you know, not very deeply, just a cynical way of trying to keep the coal industry in Australia for, you know, vastly longer than they've realised it's going to have to be.
The 4,000
if we
years
take effective worth
of coal
action
that we've got.
Yeah. And I suppose it's about the motives. So if someone is genuinely in a scientific pursuit, seeing this as a potential option if we don't act, is there ever a genuine attempt? Could these technologies ever be genuinely helpful in combating it as like a suite of policies?
I don't think it's just about the motives, because people's activities, even well-motivated activities, can have political consequences. And someone might be well-motivated and say, look, I'm researching this in case we really need it. But of course, everybody else picks up on it and says, oh, well, there's no need to worry about our emissions because we'll just deploy that technology down the track. So I think, I mean, this is very important in science, is not to think that your own motivations determine the ethics and the politics of what you're doing. And of course, it's not just individual scientists. These are large scale. I mean, you couldn't do this stuff without global concern, well, without obviously global consequences, but also without a lot of people. I mean, if you're going to spray, you know, sulfates into the upper atmosphere, we're talking about, you know, millions of jet flights to deliberately sort of change the composition of the atmosphere. Not something that individuals can do. Does depend on whether you think we really are going to be facing sort of civilizational and ecosystemic collapse if we don't do this. But of course, the moment you start talking about this technology in public, as Jim mentioned, people will think, okay, we can relax because, you know, by the time we get there, science will fix it.
Absolutely.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
You're with Steph, James, Kurt and Pat on Is Nothing Sacred? Joy 94.9.
Hi, Joyce. As you are on Is Nothing Sacred, it's 16 minutes to 11. And we've been talking with Rob Sparrow about all things, well, some things, climate engineering and so on. And I just want to make another shout out about what we talked about at the beginning of the program. And that is, if you want to hear more of this or you want to hear this discussion again, we need a podcaster.
Join us.
We'd like you to join our team. If anybody's interested in podcasting, join our team and you will get to listen to this again and again and again and podcast it. Put it up on the Joy website. And Joy is one of the biggest podcasters on iTunes at the moment. And you could help make yourself and us even more famous than we are. So I'm sitting here with the famous James and the famous Steph and the famous Patrick. And
it is an important role because the radio broadcast of Joy does have a limited, I guess, scope in terms of how far it can go geographically. So that's why podcasting, I think, is bigger with Joy than maybe some other stations because we're the voice of the community in Melbourne that can then extend outside Melbourne if you podcast.
We only have an inner metropolitan license because apparently gays and lesbians only live in the inner city area.
There aren't any in Dalesford at all.
No.
Let's just say it's essential. Anyway, we're moving on.
Move on to our actual topic.
Moving back to Robert. Robert, I was just so interested by what you were saying there, and it made me think a lot more carefully about the unintended consequences of where we've got ourselves in already. So, you know, I suppose, you know, generations before could plead ignorance on the climate change scale, certainly not since the 80s. But is it a bit about humanity feeling they can control a natural system that has great variability, and then they'll come in and change one aspect or think about one aspect in terms of an engineering sort of way, and it has unintended consequences? Is that sort of where these solutions, in inverted commas, may fall over? They might intend to do something, but what actually results
like the cane
may be
toads.
Very different. Exactly, perfect example.
Like fracking at the moment.
Yes, you'd certainly... I mean, if we get to a point where we need to climate engineer, we won't be able to stop. And that means that someone will be controlling the climate. I mean, we sort of, again, unconsciously have reshaped the climate in ways that now when there's a sort of drought or a natural disaster, there's some...
We can't stop it.
Well, I was going to say it's someone's fault. I mean, it's hard to identify the people, but once upon a time, if there was a disastrous climatic condition like a long drought, you would just have to say that's the kind of, that's the way of things.
Well, it's the gods.
Yes, that's fate. Whereas now there's really a sense in which these environmental conditions reflect human choices. And once we start geoengineering, that'll be very obvious because there'll have to be someone making decisions.
Well, let's go and examine that or explore that a bit. Who would do the governance of this? Because we've abolished, haven't we, the mechanisms that have been set up under the carbon tax and pricing carbon to...
But it would have to be bigger than that. It couldn't just be federal. It would have to be more like a body similar to, say, the United Nations, where it was all countries coming together. Not the United Nations is all countries. But
well,
surely, as you say,
it
would have to be on
the
IPCC, yeah.
So, yes, people are talking about... So this is a global project. It's not one nation might initiate it, and there's some talk that perhaps even wealthy private individuals would have the resources to actually change the climate.
You mean another Gates Trust?
Yes, I think it would be more than just the trust, but if some of the wealthiest sort of 1% of 1% set their minds to it, I gather people believe that they could make a measurable impact.
We've all read Ben Eltham's Stark, haven't we? And we see what the private enterprise do when they decide that the end of the world is coming.
Well, I mean, one of the issues in climate change and geoengineering is, of course, the effects of climate change are not universal, and they're certainly very sensitive to people's income. So, wealthy people have all sorts of resources to cushion themselves, maybe not forever. I mean, if the the food chain from the oceans collapses, which is one possibility as a result of carbon dioxide emissions, that you might see essentially the global fisheries collapse, and that would be quite a hard thing to insulate yourself from anywhere in the world. But of course, wealthier people are always going to have better bunkers, and one of the issues with the sort of global governance of geoengineering is that the impact of any policy is going to be different on different nations around the world. We're already seeing a debate where some countries are saying, look, hey, climate change is great because now we're going to be able to farm more. And once someone decides, look, we're going to reduce global temperatures through a particular policy, that will have differential impacts around the world. So it's immensely political. And indeed, giving anyone that sort of control is one of the reasons why I worry about it.
I think it sounds like the saying, you're opening a can of worms, which is completely understating it.
Do we have much information in terms of modelling, of predicting what some of the impacts would be based on what we've seen already, like the El Nino effect and things like that?
People, obviously, you'd need to be running models to do this stuff, but to return to James's question, we don't really understand global processes, and there's a terrible danger here that what we think of as a safe climate intervention will trigger some feedback effect we haven't anticipated, and then things will be disastrous, and maybe we won't be able to keep up with that. So again, it would be very foolish to think that we can do nothing now because we're going to be able to solve this problem technologically in the future.
Do we need to have a political democratic discussion about the democracy of governance in this area? And so, you know, would we have an internationally elected body to?
I think that would be the best case scenario. But if people had that kind of power now, we wouldn't be in the fix that we were in.
We're waiting for you to write the paper.
So, I mean, it sounds like the here and now message is that we should be focusing, trying to avoid getting to this situation because it seems so politically fraught, not to mention, as you say, the impacts that might be unforeseen on a scientific or level, like climate level.
Yeah, look, I think people should be absolutely panicked about climate.
You say it so calmly, Rob. People should be absolutely panicked.
If you go to our Facebook page, you'll see, and scroll back a bit, you'll actually see the article by those by the British writer who says it's the tipping point's gone. There's no point in doing anything. We may as well just live happily and enjoy all the comforts of life and realise that we're all going to die.
That used to be, I mean, quite seriously, when I was thinking about this question 5 or 10 years ago, my hope was, yes, I would die before things got really bad. Now I've got young children, and the chances that their lives will be untouched by this,
I'll be dead before minuscule.
It is very hard to put a figure on when things become absolutely terrible. I would like to hope that it was towards the end of my life, but I think my children will be facing absolutely radical social change as a result of climate change.
You better educate them properly so they can be leaders. That's a very
altruistic statement. Mm. It's beautiful. I suppose as well, before, as we wrap it up, I suppose our listeners, I think it just sort of demonstrates you know, when we think about climate change, it's easy to become desensitized because it's such a big issue. But there are just, it is such a fraught issue. And going forward, there's just so many unforeseen caveats and problems that will come out of, you know, a volatile climate.
Yeah, look, it's been a tremendous boon to philosophers because, in particular, the intergenerational justice questions in climate change are absolutely fascinating because you're trading off people's welfare now.
I hope they're all e-books you're writing.
One of the big, I think, questions about climate change is trying to negotiate that tension between your individual contribution and the social and political change that's necessary. But
isn't there a big political question about the rights of some people to have the benefit of the things that we've all had the benefit of in the West?
Certainly you can make an argument from justice that it's wrong to expect people living in the least developed countries to sacrifice the standard of living that we've achieved for the sake of our children. I think the important point to realise there is that standard of living and emissions and rates of emissions are very different things. In fact, we're already at a point where our wealth does not increase our standard of living. Mm. So it's one thing to say the model of economic development that we have chosen is unavailable to people elsewhere in the world. It's another thing to say that people don't have a right to decent human existence. We need to affirm that at the same time as we acknowledge if everyone in China and India has the lifestyle of Americans or Australians, the planet is in deep, deep trouble.
Thank you so much for coming on there, Robert. It's such an important discussion and it's been fantastic to have you on.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.